I know that we were meant to finish at 5 o'clock, and because my talk was so long, that we're running out of time. But if people want to ask questions, I think we should allow 10, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. Do you feel fine? Okay?
Yeah.
Come, take a seat. Andrew, up front. So, questions. Anybody questions? Any questions? No questions. Yes, one question. All right. Yes.
Hi, I'm not medically trained, but the question for David that might lead to you as well, even, is do you have any evidence that if patient is well prepared before they have a major facial surgery, if they're well prepared before it, do they improve quicker psychologically afterwards? And the reason I ask that question is I saw someone in January who had major surgery. She was falling apart for 45 minutes before I could do anything with her because she could not get used to the way her new face is. Now, it may well be that the surgeon had no idea what she was looking like. I don't know, so I have a friend. But she was complained into the hospital, and now she is being seen by another surgeon for a second operation. So my question to you is, if she had been prepared for, would she have taken?
Well, as you say, I don't think we've got the research evidence, but it's a very good question, and it's certainly something we want to investigate. It makes sense, and that's what good service would provide, that psychological preparation. So there is a realistic expectation of outcome, and what would have to be done afterwards to make that adaptation and so on. So it's really, I think it's really important. It makes sense.
Ian, do you want to make a comment on that?
No, I mean,
because it brings in consent, and informed consent and the rest.
Well, that's right. And I mean, one of the things I was trying to say, rather haltingly, is that research that Ian is trying to inspire shouldn't merely be research about surgical practice or about tissue engineering. It also critically involves research about attitudes both before and after, because there is a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that someone who felt well prepared and knows what they're going to go through is likely to make a slightly better recovery and a more quick recovery than the other. It's only anecdotal. But we do need that kind of research. Therefore, you need synergies between the work that David is doing and the work that Ian is doing.
I think it could actually be quite putting it to an ethics application now. Because, you know, if you want to compare the psychologist doing a psychological preparation against a little bit of, you know, a little chit-chat or something, it's actually quite hard. I suspect it would be quite difficult to get through ethics.
Carrie second, but yes, there was...
Yeah, my name's Kathy Berisnicki. I'm from Farming Arts Labs, which you might already start to think is a bit of a lot's important to me. I'm going to ask a completely different question. Ian, you've handpicked these people, these talented people, to speak today, and I've been riveted with your matter scientist. So it's been a great experience for you, and thank you for that. But you've picked them in your practice. You talent spot them in your practice. And you talent spot them for this kind of address. But it isn't common to work in an interdisciplinary way. It's not particularly encouraged. You all come from very different kinds of departments. I get the feeling that you might have even been a bit of a surprise. So how are we going to overcome the sorts of barriers that can be established because of a lack of interdisciplinarity in the way that we practice and study?
Simon, do you want to say something about that?
I think that's very interesting. Thank you for that. I mean, I very rapidly, if you look at historically, and we've come from history, Keynes Institute in the Second World War, when they fused a neurosurgeon with a dentist or an oral surgeon, which is where we come from, and an eye surgeon called Cerebral Keynes Holy Trinity. And that's what I modeled my group on. And I think it's Habib here, still here from Martin Gold, who's going to be a neurosurgeon. There's no doubt about it that actually, for me, the good luck that I had was on day one of my consultant induction, which I damn near didn't go to because I came as a red star intern here at training to be my consultant. Andrew Goodness and Sandy Paul sat next to me. So there was that initially over 3 or 4 days of being going to bash out and moving on. And I absolutely think that when you have different problems that we have, the concept of having numerous specialists all go for the common good is the way ahead. And that should be expanded further. We know that 50% of people who are assaulted end up with post-traumatic stress disorder. Why can't I have a psychologist like a clinic? They're not expensive, I'm sorry to
I'm a scientist.
Sorry. I can't have one in my clinic. You know, and you speak to your manager, and you sound like a psychologist, and you don't recognise him, because last week there were a different manager, and they've gone to fresh clinics. The way they met, the way they do run the NHS to save money, the way that you do save money is not to do that. So I think that's a fundamental thing. Whitechapel at the moment, there are actually more managers than our beds work that one out. And I'm lucky to be here this afternoon, actually. but anyway, does that go some way to answer the question? I think yes, multidisciplinary, and facilitate it takes essentially a mission of the people who want to think outside the box and think loose about people. That's not always easy to do.
And good answer, Francis?
It's such an important point. And the truth is, and we kind of almost hinted at it by the fact that, you know, the people have been put together this afternoon. The truth is that big successful units who both tackle this in a multidisciplinary way and do research in a multidisciplinary way, which is probably at least as hard, maybe even harder, it's usually because somebody, usually a clinician who knows that actually what they do needs to be more than what they're trying to do, they've actually got to go out. Somebody kind of has got to lead that, I think. And one thing I would add to that in relation to research is Ian said the research isn't expensive. The truth is it actually is incredibly expensive because it involves bringing in, you know, as soon as you say, well, I want a psychologist and a data entry person and a statistician, and we need that for every group, every centre that's actually participating in the study. This research is expensive. Because you've got to have the multidisciplinary team to do it. But I do think it's about, ultimately, it's about vision and leadership, to be honest.
So give money to the Facial Surgery Research Foundation. But Ian Kennedy, yes.
Absolutely, as I have said, critically important question. There is a great deal of talk on so-called teamwork. And though I'm surrounded by surgeons, they will be the first to admit that they believe in teamwork, provided yeah, the captain. It does need enormous vision to recognise the role of the nurse as being the prime contact between the patient for 23 hours of any day, and therefore the prime communicator of it. And the input of other specialties. There is some hope for relying on more than the energies of people who spend their night entering the data in their own logs and sharing it around, unpaid, doing it properly. There is some hope for that in that I recently chaired an international panel which was asked to designate what are being called academic health science centres. One of them is going to be here in Imperial and Mary's. And the hope there is that the very vision of it is to bring together people from the university, people from industry who are specialists in tissue engineering or whatever, or pharmacology, people from the medical school, a variety of nurses, pharmacists, whatever, into new ways of challenging how we approach illness, and also translating things that are happening in the lab and making sure they happen in the ward. There are five such centres, and the theory is that they will begin to feed out what they are discovering. And one of the things they will feed out is the central importance of larger groups attending to these issues. And the other model is what is called the model of the hub and spoke, which these guys who work in the NHS are familiar with. You get a centre like Great Ormond Street, which is really very good at looking after children. And the theory is that Great Ormond Street goes to X hospital, like trains, and is therefore the, it's Willesden, it's Great Ormond Street at Willesden, or Great Ormond Street, and they use their expertise and go out as well. Rather than leave people isolated, having no one else to talk to, doing what they've already done, which is not the way forward.
Thank you.
Donate Douglas House to Maudsley. My question is, in the fullness of time, do you think that stem cells and tissue engineering will replace conventional surgery?
Well, you don't have to, Francis. Anybody else want to make a comment? You know,
the vibration.
That's a pretty tough call. I mean, I think, as you've seen, our idea of surgery has changed so dramatically. And you know, Simon showed some remarkable video of what we would barely recognize as surgery from 25, 30 years ago, because you kind of, you know, I always think of maxillofacial surgeons as people who, you know, kind of tend to, you know, you see quite a lot going on, but actually in that particular instance, it was entirely different. So surgery will change enormously, and tissue engineering will change it, but I don't think that means it replaces surgery. It's quite interesting to, you know, whatever you think, you know, you can plan shapes, whatever, there are still actual surgical problems involved in managing those things. So it's very hard to say surgery dying is a discipline, I think. But I'm sure it will change very dramatically, as it has been.
Surgeons will be very different, because if you reach into your pocket, that was the right pocket, you pull out a computer. And so younger individuals growing up into surgery will have a completely different perception of the technologies that we use around us, not just in surgery. They will be like sponges, able to do things in completely different ways without breaking a sweat.
And certainly if you look at cardiac surgery is reduced down as the cardiologist has become more involved in doing more and more procedures. So there are changes all the time. And the use of the computer in the pocket means, for example, my son at any pub quiz is always going to the lavatory.
I'll make a brief comment. I work with Professor of Psychiatry at Barnes & Mudden, and we have a psychology PhD student doing research, and she has a medical student who's doing a kind of BSc dissertation with the PhD student who I'm co-supervising. So the point is that we're trying to build a factory of PhD students. So that's what we're trying to do. At the Maudsley,
I wouldn't disagree with that. But I mean, it's both physical measures as well as psychological, psychosocial measures,
yeah.
And both in the quiet profession.
Yes?
Hi,
I'm
Jane.
I'm
a staff nursing at
the Petrus
Hospital.
Just
interested
to
know why
I
can't use
a
cane and
jewels.
Do you
want
to ask
that? You can. And I do, not with regularity, but you can use plates and screws, and however they're engineered, they're plates and screws. And the problem is that you've got to have flesh covering. If you don't have flesh covering, that's a problem. Some cases that Dale has shown, there is no skin covering it, and you cannot leave, although people have tried, you can't leave titanium by and large free to the atmosphere. The exception being one exception, you said the Tarlis experience, when you can actually get titanium from bone, going through bone, through skin, masquerading as a tooth core that you can dental implants in, which is very exciting. But that's it's been a long year for that affair, long years for that to work, and requires formations that are near carved skin line. So that's the reason why. She simply, that's why Ian brings, with his techniques of bringing in flesh, meat, bone, as
attached an artery and vein, which he then looks for a very high power microscope, and sews these little vessels less than a millimetre in diameter or 2 millimetres to nourish the flap, if you like. It's purely for that reason, during which you'll have composite tissue to fill a composite defect. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yes.
Any other questions? Right, well, thank you very much for being such an appreciative audience. Thank you for coming along. I think there's some truth outside, don't there?
There are indeed. I have two things to say before we end. That's quite thanking Ian for putting all this show together with us. First is that you will see on another sort of related topic, global organ trafficking. Our next BioCentre event will be in House of Westminster in November. Your half day seminar on the policy ramifications of organ trafficking. Secondly, as you know, the main reason you come to symposium is to fill out the evaluation forms. So it'd be good if some of you would do that, and we have drinks, and we hope you will join us and that you will hang around and meet all these people some more. And thank you again. Thank you.